I'm back after a month. This is Dr. Joe Parisi with you until 4 o'clock. But in the first hour of the program, in this first hour, we're going to be talking about nuclear energy. The reason I bring this up is because now there is a push, particularly from the campaigns of McCain and Sarah Palin, to drastically increase the number of nuclear power plants. In fact, McCain has said, I'd build 1,000 of them if I could. This is going to have a major impact because money going into nuclear power plants, for instance, capital costs are very high. There's only so much money, and the question is, where do we put scarce resources now that we have to come up with alternative sources of energy? Nuclear energy has been supported by large numbers of people who know what they're talking about, and it's also been opposed by large numbers of people who also know what they're talking about. So what I've done this hour of the program is to bring into the studio two individuals who know a great deal about nuclear power because they're nuclear physicists. These are people that will soon be getting their doctoral degrees from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. They're closely involved in nuclear energy, its strengths, its shortcomings, etc. And they will explain to us, as best they can, in ways that I hope that we can understand, the benefits of going nuclear for the production of electricity. Before I introduce them, I've got still my producer in the studio, as well as Mary Silver. And they don't know why they're here, other than the fact that they've got my show to do. But I wanted to ask them a question before we go on. And that is, if I say the word nuclear, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Sadly, I have to say The Simpsons.
You gotta be kidding.
The Simpsons?
It's still early for me on a Saturday.
This word, if I say nuclear.
Radiation.
Radiation coming from what?
That's just the first thing that pops into my head.
Yeah, but what would that radiation come from?
The rods.
The rods?
Yeah.
I don't believe you. You're being...
I'm being serious.
You're being serious.
I'm being dead serious.
Mary, what's your first reaction?
Well, I'm from Pennsylvania. My first reaction is Three Mile Island, because I would have been the first to get it, since I live not too far away from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have more radiation in my body than I bet you do because of that.
Well, maybe that's why you're a lot thinner. And
could be.
Well, it's interesting because last week I was sitting home. And I was surfing through, and I saw the new version on television. Actually, new was the early 90s, but I had never heard of it before this. The newest version of On the Beach. Now, I remember On the Beach, the old version with Gregory Peck and, who else was in there? Tony Perkins was in that movie. Ava Gardner. It's about Australia after a nuclear war.
Okay.
And the people who had survived and what they were going to do. And I saw this new version on there. So in preparing for the program, what I decided to do is to just ask a number of people that I knew, as many as I could, the word nuclear, what comes to your mind right away? Now, there were some generational differences, but just about everybody who heard that word said bombs.
Yeah.
They
you
saw
would think
mushroom
of Hiroshima,
clouds.
Even though
That's
that
correct.
Wasn't nuclear.
Hiroshima wasn't nuclear?
I thought it was atomic. Is that the same thing?
It's the same thing,
though. Is it really?
Yes, yeah.
Well,
it's splitting atoms.
My hair is blonde.
Okay. Yes, it's splitting atoms. And it's interesting. Now, some of the younger ones, like yourselves, said reactors. And the more educated, you know, would have said things like you said, rods. I don't think most of my audience would say that. When you say the word nuclear, most people think of nuclear weapons, and they see a mushroom cloud. Now, I'm the same way, but for me, at my age, I was a kid in the early 50s, and you could get up for the Today Show, and you could watch nuclear weapons exploded out at Yucca Flats in Nevada. They would televise them. And so I got used to the idea of nuclear meaning bombs. Now, we heard these things about producing electricity, but, you know, they were far off, and, you know, it never stuck. So my generation is really stuck with that impression, and I think that might be a reason why there's so much resistance to it. Now, there are a number of people who think that when a nuclear power plant goes bad, it ends up like an atomic bomb. We're going to find out, of course, today that's not true. Chernobyl was not an atomic bomb. In fact, I was in, was Chernobyl in 86? I was there in 83. Not in Chernobyl. I was in Kiev in a town that was about 45 miles from where Chernobyl is, okay? I got out of there in time, 3 years before it melted down. The point I'm getting at is that I think nuclear power, in part, is unfairly tagged simply because people think right away of bombs. And they think, like you said, radiation, you know, and all that implies. Well, we're going to take a look at nuclear energy this hour of the program to find out, you know, what are the myths and what are the realities, you know, of nuclear power. And to do that, I brought in two nuclear physicists, two engineers, whatever you want to call them. They're doctoral students who are getting PhDs in this stuff. To me, if you have a bachelor's in this, you're farther ahead than most people. But they know what they're talking about, and I think it's safe to describe that they are advocates of nuclear power for any number of reasons. You will have a chance in the second half hour of the program to ask them whatever questions that are on your mind on nuclear power. But with no further ado, I want to introduce to you Kathy Romano. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Let me bring your microphone closer to you. And Riyadh, how do you pronounce your last name?
Baran.
Riyadh Baran. Riyadh and Kathy are both students at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI. They're getting their doctorates in nuclear energy, nuclear physics. They know something about nuclear power, and I want to get on to the questions as soon as I can. First of all, the fission process. This is the way I've always learned it. U-235, when hit with a neutron, breaks up into barium and krypton and energy. Is that still the equation?
Sort of. That's a very specific equation. That's only one of the splits.
Mm-hmm.
Uranium-235 can split into any number of elements,
mm-hmm.
A wide variety of them, as a matter of fact. But that's the basics. The uranium.
Now, what is the basic science behind this, then? To achieve nuclear power for the purpose of producing electricity, what do we have to do that?
Well, basically, fission releases energy, using Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared. Some of the mass during the process turns into energy, and that is turned into heat in the nuclear reactor. This heat then is transferred to water, which is then boiled from the heat. And
mm-hmm.
basically, it's very similar to, say, a coal fire plant. The boiling water, the steam, then turns the turbines, which turns the generators and creates electricity.
What is the difference then between a chemical reaction, which occurs in a coal fire plant, as opposed to a nuclear reaction that occurs in a nuclear power plant?
Well, one of the best things about it is that nuclear power reactions do not emit any carbon. So it's a very, very clean energy, and it's actually a renewable energy. We can make more fuel when we run out of it.
Mm-hmm. We can make uranium?
We can't make U-235, but we can make U-233, which can be used as fuel. We can make more plutonium-239, which can also be used as fuel.
Make plutonium. You realize, of course, what do you do with that after you make it? I mean, plutonium is, from what I understand, is the most poisonous toxic substance on the planet.
Actually, that's not true.
No. Okay.
It's the scariest, I would think, but it's really not the most toxic. There are other radioactive materials that actually we are a little bit more worried about handling than plutonium. Basically, we can create new fuel. Now, the plutonium, we actually have a program now where we're buying weapons plutonium from Russia, and we're also using some of the plutonium from weapons in the United States, some of the stockpile. And we're actually turning that into nuclear fuel, and we're taking, we're not burning the plutonium yet, but we are burning the uranium, the enriched uranium used for nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And turning that into nuclear fuel, and we're actually burning that in our reactors right now. And as a matter of fact, one out of every 10 United States light bulbs in the year 2005 was powered by nuclear energy from warheads from Soviet weapons.
How much nuclear energy supplies electricity to the state of New York? Do you have any idea? I heard the word 13%. That's why. Is that
That could be true. I think, well, we know nationally it's about 20%.
Mm-hmm. Nationally it's about 20%, and if we're talking about the emissions-free electricity that we get in this country, nuclear power represents 70% in comparison to wind and solar.
Mm-hmm.
And by emissions-free, we mean when you compare nuclear energy, when you compare the carbon emissions to the fossil fuel-based, the heavy carbon fuels, it's much cleaner. But it's also even cleaner than wind and solar, believe it or not, if you look at the whole cycle.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about nuclear energy this hour of the program. My guest, Kathy Romano from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She is a graduate student who will soon be getting a PhD sometime around probably May of next year. We also have another graduate student with her. His name is Riyad Garan, and he's also a doctoral student at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. These people know the nuclear power industry, nuclear power reactors, and its capabilities pretty well. That's why I brought them here, and we'll be talking some more. We're up for a break. This is Dr. Joe Parisi. We'll be right back. And the time is 1:24. The station is News Talk 590 WROW, and this is Dr. Joe Parisi with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. This hour of the program, we're talking about nuclear energy. We are in an energy crisis. No matter what you hear in the campaigns, we are. It's here. T. Boone Pickens has said it. You see his ads on television. We have to come up with alternatives. And one of the alternatives that's now being talked about once again is nuclear energy. We have nuclear power plants to be built. Depending upon what our goals are, that will determine how many plants we would build to produce electricity. I have with me Kathy Romano. Kathy is a doctoral student at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. That's RPI. She'll be getting her doctorate in nuclear physics, I imagine, sometime around May. Riyad Garan. Is it Bahrain?
It's Bahrain.
Bahrain. Okay. I'm sorry. I keep mispronouncing your name, but it's not intentional. He is also a graduate student at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. These people know what they're talking about. And so I thought, generally, as you know my reputation on my programs, I try to get people in who, in fact, on every topic I cover, know what they're talking about. My knowledge of basic science is it's essentially Neolithic when it comes to stuff like this. But we're talking about nuclear power and the possibilities. How does nuclear energy compare to the other source of energy in terms of greenhouse gas emissions first?
Well, when you measure how clean a source of energy is, you think of carbon emissions, how much carbon is going out into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about these fossil fuel carbon-based oil, coal, they have tremendous emissions. And nuclear, and also with wind and solar and these other, are considered emissions-free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's well known. But then you can even go deeper and compare nuclear power to wind and solar, which are emissions-free once you have the technology. But if you look at the whole cycle, I mean, how did you come to make that solar panel? When you have it in front of you, it's giving you electricity without emitting carbon. But there was a manufacturing process, just like there was a construction process.
That required oil.
That's right. Just like there was a construction process for the nuclear power plant. And when you compare those over the whole lifetime of this source of energy, nuclear energy still wins the emissions fight.
All right. What about the energy in versus the energy out?
What do you mean?
The equation that shows that how much energy has to be put into producing nuclear energy as compared to what you, in fact, finally get out of it.
Right.
I mean, there are some situations where it requires more energy to make the thing. One of the things that's the shortcomings of biofuels, for instance, particularly ethanol right now, is you're finding out that the energy required to make the stuff, when the stuff is finally made, doesn't deliver the energy it took to make it. And it's not. It's just not a reliable, not a feasible way of running cars, for instance. So you've got something here which produces tremendous amounts of energy. What are the inputs into it?
Okay, I have in front of me a chart that discusses that exact topic. And we have statistics on the lifetime energy ratio output divided by the input. So the higher the number, the more energy out versus energy in. Nuclear is 59 of output versus input.
What does that mean? It's 59 output versus input.
The energy out, divided by the energy in is 59. So the larger the number, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look at, compared to wind, is 34, so there's more energy in. For solar, you're looking at 9, a figure of 9, and that's mm-hmm. the lifetime energy out versus input. It takes a lot of energy to create a solar panel.
Mm-hmm. And this is just another way of looking at what I was talking about,
yeah.
because when you say more energy in to create it, it's probably using oil or kerosene or some carbon-based fuel, and it's going to be more it'll be more intensive in terms of emissions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next question, then. It does reduce, you say, our dependence on foreign oil in the long run, you're saying.
Correct.
It can. How does it relate to our... One of the things that I heard at a meeting that I went to several weeks ago was the fact the problem with our energy situation is not that we can't produce electricity. These people say you can. We can produce all the electricity we need. The problem is liquid fuels, transportation. That's what we're running low on. That's what's going to nail us if we don't do something about it, about alternative sources of energy. And yet you have said in the break that nuclear energy can be a way of providing the transportation fuel that we need to go where we have to go.
That's right. So instead of just talking about nuclear energy for electricity for cars, we can talk about hydrogen, because mm-hmm. cars have a short range, and a lot of people, at least in this country, they want to be able to drive longer than 100 miles before they have to plug in their car again.
Mm-hmm.
So hydrogen is another solution, and there are many cars that today that are the technology is there, but there's no clean way to make hydrogen right now. They burn methane to create hydrogen, but
yes.
nuclear energy can efficiently create hydrogen. What we have is there's a type of reactor called a high temperature gas reactor,
mm-hmm.
and what this does is it sends the heat from the core of the nuclear power plant into a processing center,
mm-hmm.
and it also sends some electricity. And at this center, you have a process called high-temperature electrolysis. And all this is, it's just fancy jargon for a very efficient and clean process to make hydrogen. And it's becoming more and more economically viable, especially with the price of oil that's increasing exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a technology that we should implement. It would require a hydrogen infrastructure in the United States and government support. But it's a possibility. It would reduce your dependence on foreign oil. And it would be, in what you said, a liquid fuel that could have a range of more than 100 miles.
Mm-hmm. How am I going to phrase this? Nuclear power could be used then to produce the hydrogen necessary to run hydrogen-based cars. We don't have those yet, but we assume that at some point we will. What about desalinization of water?
It's also efficient at purifying water, and that's not as big an issue in this country as it is in developing countries, which are looking at nuclear power, in fact,
mm-hmm.
For water desalination.
Mm-hmm.
Another application also, and what we're talking about, when we talk about water desalination or hydrogen production, we're not using the electricity from nuclear power, we're using the process heat. A third application of this process heat is to extract oil from tar sands and oil shale in this country, where
mm-hmm.
the oil is deep in the rock and it needs heat to kind of melt and be able to be pumped up. And that could also reduce our dependency on foreign oil for the short term,
mm-hmm.
at least. And the reserves are tremendous.
We are talking with Kathy Romano of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Riyad Bahran from RPI as well. We're going to be going to the news right now, but we will be back with more of this discussion. And you are now able to call in. You're invited to call in. Our numbers are 476-5959, pound 590, and a cell phone. We will be right back. Here's Mary with the news. This is Dr. Joe Parisi with you until prices. Don't let the gasoline price fool you. It's not going to go much below what it is now. And if it does, it won't stay there. You better get used to $100 a barrel. We're going to have to start thinking in the future. And the future may very well be a nuclear future for a country the size of the United States. We can talk about wind at some other time. We can talk about fossil fuels. But today it's nuclear, because what I want to do is be able to get the strengths and the shortcomings out, but also the myths as opposed to the realities of it. And there are a lot of myths about nuclear power that need to be dealt with and exploded before people are going to be willing to accept, you know, the expansion of this industry. With me this afternoon is Kathy Romano. Kathy is a graduate student at RPI, and she will be getting her doctorate probably sometime in May. You don't get doctorates in nuclear physics that easy. So she knows what she's talking about, along with her partner here, Rian Baran. Rian is also, you're from Yemen, you said, huh?
That's right.
Much business in Yemen for nuclear power plants?
Not today, anyways.
Not today. But it's interesting because if they had them, probably they could do a great deal, couldn't they, with a reliable supply of electricity like that?
They could, and especially with the water purification.
We need
water. Sana'a is one of the capital of Yemen,
mm-hmm.
is running out of water slowly, and it's sad.
Well, we're running out of it in the western part of the United States as well. The water wars have already started. There's an attempt on the part of the casino types in Las Vegas to run a pipe down from Lake Mead at millions of gallons of water every single day because Las Vegas is growing so much, and that's got the farmers and the ranchers going cuckoo out there. And you can see the bitterness that's beginning to emerge over this because of the scarcity of resources. And if we had a system of desalinizing water, that would be incredible. You know, I mean, to supply a continental, you know, like we're going to need that. And I got a feeling that probably nuclear power is going to play, you know, a role in, you know, in achieving that. We have a caller first before I get to next to my question. Let's go to Scott over in Waterford. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Dr. Joe. I've been listening and enjoying the topic. I have a couple questions. One, and I understand that our focus should be on nuclear. I'd like to just quickly ask, though, why go to hydrogen vehicles when the electric vehicles, the infrastructure, you know, as far as delivery goes, is already there? Specifically, I don't know if you guys know who James Woolsey is.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Joe, I imagine you do.
Yeah.
Former
CIA,
CIA director under Bill Clinton. Huge advocate for skipping hydrogen, going straight to EV, and he has a speech where he gets up there and he says, I brought my infrastructure with me, and he's got a lead cord.
Problem is storage, as I understand it. That's one of the biggest obstacles. Nobody seems to be able to get a battery that will go any more than 150 miles without a charge.
I agree with you. Storage, it's like, and the two guests that you have may be able to speak to this, but it has something to do with storage and weight, you know, how much something weighs versus how much power you can stuff into it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a company called EE Store, and they're actually building capacitors instead of batteries. So it's one-tenth the weight of a battery with the same amount of potential energy storage.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, I have an electric bicycle. This is something that allows me, you know, 12 to 15 miles range, cost me 2 cents to charge it, and the battery lasts me about 2 years.
Well, I know that the Union College people, maybe you're familiar, you know Frank Wicks, down at the engineering department at Union College, they're building a car right now, but he says this is the future. Cars will weigh no more than 500 pounds, and they're going to have a range, you know, like regular cars, but a speed limit, maximum of 40 miles an hour. He says that's the only way we're going to get out of this. Is that
well,
kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, a lot of the electric vehicles actually have incredible performance. There's a Tesla Roadster is a $100,000 sports car, which they've got, you know, the first 1,000 sold already. So you can do the math on that. But
mm-hmm.
The electric engine, or the electric motor, I should say, allows for optimal torque right off the line. So you get a continuous acceleration. In addition to that,
Scott, I want to keep the discussion on
nuclear. Let me get back to my nuclear question.
Okay.
I do have an actual nuclear question.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry about that. It's specifically, could you guys talk about waste reprocessing?
We're going to talk about it right now.
Oh, that's great. And also, as far as the downside, I like the idea of nuclear, but also could you talk about long-term waste storage? And what has to be taken into account there?
Okay, thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you.
I was about to get to that anyway, the whole problem of waste. Could you have a comment first?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I actually wanted to comment on the... I did see these websites and these companies that are selling these electrical bikes, and
mm-hmm.
There's actually a few, and they look pretty good. And I think I'm not disagreeing with you that that electric cars... you'd need about 200 nuclear power plants right now to have a capacity to sustain changing everybody's car into an electric car. But I've seen these this Tesla, that their tagline is burn rubber, not gas. And they are, I mean, there are advancements, and it is a possibility. Hydrogen is just an alternative, and it's probably a more long-term alternative.
I know, it's very hard to store, though. That I understand. I mean, it has to be stored under tremendous pressure because it's such a light gas.
Right.
I just don't like the idea of a bunch of Hindenburgs traveling down the road next to me. Kathy, you were going to say something.
I was going to address the reprocessing.
Yes.
Basically, right now, the reason why we're not reprocessing is it's mostly a political issue, partially economic, but mostly political, in that, again, when people think of reprocessing nuclear fuel, they think of making nuclear weapons. And back in the 70s, Jimmy Carter decided that we were not going to reprocess anymore because we were going to set the example for the rest of the world as far as getting rid of our nuclear weapons. So we haven't done that in a long time. However, we do have the technology. And the great thing about reprocessing is a little known fact, actually was surprising to me, is that if we just take the uranium ore and do a once through cycle, in other words, just take the spent fuel out of the reactors and then store it, we're looking at about 100 years worth of uranium that we know about, that we know exists. But if we recycle, we can change that to thousands of years of fuel, and we can even breed. And in Japan, the United Kingdom, and France, they're doing that now. So we can extend our fuel supplies indefinitely. The other great thing about recycling our fuel is that we're going to reduce our waste by 90%.
Really?
Yes.
So when you recycle fuel, you're going to be really producing more fuel. Is that what the whole fast breeder reactor does?
Yes, the fast breeder reactor makes more fuel. And those are a little bit different cycles than the cycles we're familiar with now with mm-hmm. the uranium-235. But just by recycling our U-235 and our plutonium, which some plutonium is created in a normal reactor that we use now, that plutonium, we can remove that, re-enrich our fuel, and burn the plutonium in reactors.
Mm-hmm. And listeners can think about it this way. If we have a football field with spent fuel, with recycling, you'd reduce it to the end zone only.
Mm. Let's go to Saratoga and talk with Bill. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hello. I know that France and Japan, among other countries, have big nuclear industries. What do those countries do with the waste and the pipes and everything, the water and everything? I mean, I assume they've solved the problem because they're actually using it.
Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Bill, for the question. The thing is, Japan and France, they do recycle, but they have not, nobody has fully solved the, or let me put it this way, nobody has a final repository yet for spent fuel. And, for example, in the United States, we keep it, we have interim storage, we keep it at the sites, which are very safe.
Mm-hmm.
So although we have spent fuel at most of the reactor sites, they keep it safe, and they're looking at a solution. And in the United States, it's mainly a political issue right now that they have to work through, but the science is pretty sound. And in Japan and in France, since they recycle, they have less waste to worry about, but I'm pretty sure they don't have a final repository either, because, again, it's a political issue that is that needs healthy debate, regardless of what country you're in.
So what do they do with it in the meantime?
Well, they recycle, so they're still, they still recycle the fuel, and they're using it, so they probably have little fuel that's ready to go into a final repository.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call, Bill. In terms of the waste, we heard somebody from our organization, the Capital Region Energy Forum, which I'm a member, we heard somebody from GE Global Research talk about nuclear power. And he said that they could store, it is possible to store it safely for 100,000 years. That true?
Well, what we do now...
That's longer than we've been on the planet as Homo sapiens.
Part of the way that we're looking at permanently storing the nuclear waste is encapsulating the highly radioactive waste in either glass or ceramic.
Mm-hmm.
So the glass does not decay over time. We take these glass or ceramic pieces and put them into large containers that are shielded with lead, and they've been thoroughly safety tested, and we can put them into the ground. Part of the reason why Yucca Mountain looked pretty good was because of the very low water table and the way the rock is formed underneath the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it a very safe way.
We're coming up on a break. This is Dr. Joe Farisi. With me in the studio is Kathy Romano, who is from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, and Rian Baran, who is also a graduate student in nuclear physics, nuclear engineering. We'll be back after this short break. The time is 1:55. We are at News Talk Radio 590 WROW. This is Dr. Joe Farisi. We have 5 minutes left in the program. I want to get right back to the phones then. Jerry in Schenectady. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Dr. Joe. Hello to your guests, too. It's nice to have you back, Dr. Joe.
Thank you.
All right. First of all, a few questions about uranium ore. Where do we get it from? Like, is it far down in the ground, or is it pretty close to the surface? Is it difficult to mine? And what part of the world does most of it come from?
Well, most of the uranium is in the United States and Australia and Canada.
Really?
And South Africa. So when you mine uranium, it's pretty much like doing any other type of metal mining. And you just kind of go down there and dig it out. The other method of uranium mining is called leach mining, where you can drill some bore holes and put down water that is oxygenated, and that will dissolve it and turn the uranium into a type of sludge, and we pump that out. That's a little bit easier to do, a little less expensive. The dangers with uranium mining are about the same as other mines. You've got radon, but there are ways to control that, and we just need to make sure that the workers do not inhale or ingest the uranium.
I see. So it would still help us be energy self-sufficient. We wouldn't be dependent mostly on other countries for uranium.
Well, it depends. Now, different types of reactors use different uranium. If you dig uranium from the ground, you still have to do some enrichment. There's a process that you do to make it go into a nuclear reactor, and we do have the technology, and we do have this process. So in the United States, I think we're not going to have a big problem, provided that we eventually go to recycling. It's really a bigger problem worldwide. And you know what? There are international agencies. The International Atomic Energy Agency is a UN subsidiary that watches nuclear power. And they provide fuel assurances to, for example, if a developing country like Yemen, if they want to have nuclear power and they don't want to deal with the sensitive parts of the fuel cycle, which is, you know, digging the uranium from the ground, that's not so sensitive. But putting it, enriching it, which is, this is what Iran is dealing with, because they're trying to enrich their own uranium, and they're under a lot of scrutiny. So you know, there is, it's a more of an international problem, and there are solutions, but the United States, I don't think, should be too worried about the uranium supply.
Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate it. I want to go to Dennis in Albany. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, hi, and welcome back, Dr. Joe.
Thank you, Dennis.
And, you know, for years I've been hearing about the advantages of fusion over fission, and how
I was going to ask that myself.
Yes, and we're always 10 years away, and I was just going to ask your guest, how many years away are we, and what are the advantages of fusion over
fission? Okay, you got 1 minute left to tell us about fusion.
Okay, well, fusion energy is about 50 years away. The problem is we have not been able to get close to getting as much energy out as getting energy in. There's an international ITER project where billions of dollars are going in to research fusion, and this may be the answer, but it's at least 50 years away right now.
50 years away. That's a long yes for now.
I just had one last comment to all your viewers. Nuclear engineering is a good major to be in these days.
Yes, it is. I would imagine it is. So those of you who are aspiring scientists out there, take yourself over to RPI and introduce yourself to these people. I'm sure they can help you. We're coming up on News on the Hour, but we'll be back with more of this program. This is Dr. Joe Farisi. I want to thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
As well as Kathy.
Thank you.
We'll be talking again, I'm sure.
Depend on the news and talk of the Capital Region.